Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.
I'm Farai Chidea, and this is One with Farai, a show about how visionaries integrate life, work, and passion. Today I'm speaking with author and activist Gloria Steinem, who has spent most of her life championing feminism and equal rights for all. Gloria, it is great to talk to you.
It's great to be here.
I think about you as someone who has a family. You don't have biological children, but you and I got to know each other at the same time that I first got to know Amy Richards, who is someone who has been an important part of your life, who lived with you for a time when she was a younger woman, and now she's married with children. And I think that one of the many things that women are grappling with is, how do you construct a family of choice? And it seems to me that you do have a family of choice, which is bigger than Amy Richards, a writer, activist, entrepreneur, mm-hmm. and you have quite a large family of choice. Do you think of it that way?
I do. I often use the term chosen family.
Yeah.
Actually, there was a sort of scholar of the family who said, your biological family serves reliable purposes, obviously, to nurturing, seeing people of different ages, because in the rest of your life you might tend to pick people of a similar age. Obviously, your family of birth plays an important role. And then she said, and it's important that you learn how to get along with and even love people you don't like, that for the future of the human race is really important. And that was such a liberation to me, because we tend to think that our biological family is, we are supposed to agree with them. And in a way, it's a function of the family that we don't and get along and love each other anyway. So we then also make a chosen family of people who share values and interests and support us in a different way. And I think we all need that. I think everybody needs that. And especially people in social justice movements, because the world doesn't quite run the way, to put it mildly. You know, if people, for whatever reason, are on the periphery, then we need a time of being in the center to feel supported.
So when you came into the studio, you were talking about an event you went to for Makers, which is an amazing PBS series, which you, of course, have been featured on. But tell me a little bit about the event you went to and the young girl who was part of it.
This is for a girl who's now 11. Probably if you saw her on Makers, she was maybe 10 at the time. And she played football with her brothers. And even though her brother's friends said, oh, we have to beat the girl on the team, she was good at it. And so she became a football player in the local team. And she's still very good at it, except now she's decided she wants to play soccer and enter the Olympics. But why I was saying that to you was because I was just so moved by the fact that she is at 11 years old, totally herself. You know, she has what you and I hope everyone has, which is a feeling of, I'm not more important than you, but I'm not less important either.
Yeah.
And it just brought tears to my eyes.
Yeah. Well, it's so interesting where we are today with both the embrace of feminism and gender equality, and still a lot of discomfort with the word feminism and people who perceive it as being anti-male. So I wanted to play a clip from actor Emma Watson, who, of course, was in the Harry Potter series, as she addressed the UN on gender.
How can we affect change in the world when only half of it is invited or feel welcome to participate in the conversation? Men, I would like to take this opportunity to extend your formal invitation. Gender equality is your issue too.
To what extent do you believe that men believe what this actor said?
Probably it depends, as it does with all of us, on their individual situation. For instance, I have seen at press conferences enormous professional football players with tears streaming down their cheeks talking about what it meant to them, how terrible it was for them to see their mothers humiliated and beaten. And they are very much part of the anti-violence movement. On the other hand, I am often approached by men who say, well, you must be very happy. And I say, why? And they say, because you've won. I said, what makes you think, you know, because they have no, it's kind of no idea of what it means. So I think probably it, men become allies, you might say, in the same way that people become racial allies or class allies, when both sides see they have something to gain in it. And there are many more men now who do, either because they have daughters and so they identify with their daughters, or because they themselves have been restricted by the idea of being masculine and so they couldn't do what they wanted to do. But I think it comes, the most reliable kind of alliance comes out of real life experience and shared purpose.
Mutual self-interest is something that we've talked about in other episodes of this series, one with Farai. I spoke with Urvashi Vaid, who, of course, you know, about, you know, what does it take to construct a mutual self-interest around issues of equality facing LGBT people, but also just in the criminal justice system. What have you found as you have walked this path for decades of championing gender equality that makes people who may not, you know, embrace the word feminism off the bat say, well, yeah, I do have a stake in this.
I think that there are many big issues that you can quote. For instance, we now know from studies of, you know, like 100 modern countries that the biggest determinant of whether the country is violent inside itself or will be willing to use violence against, military violence against another country, is actually less poverty or access to natural resources or religion or even degree of democracy than it is violence against females. Not because female life is any more important than male life, but because that's what we tend to see first in our families. We think that masculine and feminine roles are inevitable and therefore dominance and passivity or obedience are the norm. And that kind of digs a trench in our brains for race and class and caste and everything else. So you can see it in that way, I think, as fundamental to everything else. And or you can have experienced it in a very personal way. You know, that your mom made two-thirds of the salary of the guy working next to her, and therefore you didn't have money for college. You know, I mean, yes. And we all come to it in our own way. But I think, one, when you're talking about Urvashi, I just want to make clear that when we're talking about this, we're talking about kind of one big movement, however you enter it, because we aren't quite past the era, I'm sorry to say, when we see movements as silos. So kids on campus will say to me, how come the same groups are against lesbians and contraception? This seems to them irrational.
I love that.
And you have to say, well, I know on the surface, but the truth is that those groups see any sexual expression that isn't directed towards conception as immoral. So that's why our adversaries are the same. And once we see that, then we see we have common cause.
Yeah. Well, I want to go a little bit more on this kind of pop culture tip. I brought up what Emma Watson was talking about, but in the media, there are celebrities who claim feminism, there's celebrities who don't, including Madonna, who said, I'm not a feminist, I'm a humanist, which strikes me as fascinating since I watched her during her club years and her ascent into pop culture. Katy Perry also says, I'm not a feminist. What do you think women are really saying, whether they're famous or not, when they say, I'm not a feminist?
Well, they're saying one of two things, probably. Either they really don't know what it means, and if you sent them to the dictionary to see that it just means somebody, male or female, who believes in the full equality of women and men, they might change their minds. But if they do know what it means and still don't espouse it, then they may be, you know, given who you're talking about, who are obviously independent women, then they may just be, not just, but afraid of punishment. Because, you know, to say you want equality for yourself is daring, but to say you want equality for all women is bigger than a revolution. So they may just be trying to avoid punishment, which, of course, doesn't work. But I try to say to them, if you were a civil rights advocate, would you say you weren't? You know, if you were working against anti-Semitism, would you say you weren't? And I think that all helps. And I do think now people somehow think that the word feminism has become unpopular. So as an old person, I would just like to say it's much more popular than it used to be. You know, the reason you know me is partly because we were like 12 crazy people, you know, so we got identified. But now defined, it's a huge majority issue. Undefined, it's 30% at least of the public. And more women identify as feminists than as Republicans, for instance. And we have Beyonce putting, you know, the word feminist on the stage, huge, 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 in glowing letters. And bringing the great Nigerian novelist on to describe what feminism is. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's definitely the trend line is up.
Yeah, it's interesting. Even there, you know, she got some criticism from Annie Lennox, Beyonce did, about whether her stage presence, her sexuality on stage clashed with feminism. So that's a whole other conversation we may circle back to. But I just want to say that I was at a meeting before I came here to the studio to talk to you. And I said, oh, I'm going to interview Gloria Steinem for a podcast I do. And the person was like, oh, is she as great in person as she, you know, as she is just as a, you know, as a public figure? And I said, she's even better. And I really do believe that. You have been incredibly generous to me throughout my life and career in including me in circles of interesting women, bringing me into conversations. And I think that you're someone who you have a very profound impact on the public. But part of what we talk about here on the show is also about private. And how do you recharge yourself? You put so much energy out in the world, and you're so much a part of so many people's lives. How do you find that well of energy to...
Well, apparently I come here and be interviewed by you.
I would like to think that
no, but I mean, you just said this, you know, wonderful, rewarding thing, and I deeply appreciate that. I do think it's important, that question, because we are communal creatures. And if we are too much alone for any reason, even a positive reason, we can come to feel wrong or crazy or, you know, so I do think that it's very, very important, maybe especially in the age of the internet in some ways, to be physically together at least once a week or once a month with your friends and people who make you feel smart, not dumb, you know, who support you. It doesn't matter how different we appear to be or what we're doing is different, but we support each other and each other's values and have a trust level. Because we are, animals are communal. And in every culture, I think, isolation is the greatest punishment. Because we're such a, you know, one person off into the blue culture, we forget how important the communal is. And every movement that I know of has come out of that. I mean, you know, speaking the truth in churches in the South was the part of the beginning of the civil rights movement. Women in their living rooms and CR groups, and now they call them book clubs, I guess. I don't, you know, yeah. That's core to the women's movement. Speaking bitterness groups gave birth to the Chinese Revolution, I think. So, and we need to continue that. In a way, women especially may need to find a kind of psychic family of friends, because women are sometimes the servants in their own households. And therefore, it's too much a reminder of playing a role. It may be wonderful, but it may not fully set them free.
Yeah. So, Gloria, our first podcast guest was Tanya Selvaratnam, the author of The Big Lie, Motherhood, Feminism, and the Reality of the Biological Clock. And it really makes a case that part of living a full life as a woman is choosing whether or not to have children and how and when. And part of the cycle that we're in has meant that people my age, I'm 45 and Tanya's not much younger, people in our generation sometimes delayed or deferred child rearing to accomplish other things. My question to you is, what do you think that young women today in their 20s have learned from my generation and your generation and, you know, how we construct an idea of being a self-actualized woman?
I agree with you that younger women are more cognizant, I think, of what their choices are. But I think the universe that you describe in the workforce was and is because the workforce was adapted to male human beings. That's the problem with the workforce. And we have to make room for women who want to have children and men who want to be real parents. We have to transform the idea of what work is. Every European country is ahead of us. Canada is ahead of us in this regard. The idea that the worker is somebody who doesn't care about children and is just giving his paycheck to keep them in house and home, you know, is just not true. I don't think it's fair to blame the women's movement for creating that kind of workforce. That's the way it is. And we need to be aware of choices, absolutely, as they reveal themselves. We need to help each other as best we can. But I would also say something slightly different, which is I question the pressure to have children, to have biological children. And what worries me about it, and certainly I support whatever it is that the individual wants, but to want to have children so much that you will go and use a surrogate in another country when you know that that woman is only doing it because she's poor and is going to have to pass her child on after gestation, I question that. You know, I think if we need some influence to come out with individual free choice, I would say it's really questioning the whole idea that there's some magic to biology. Actually, you know, each of us is such a combination of millennia upon millennia of heredity and environment in such an unpredictable way. We should just look at families and realize, you know, there's no guarantee that just because you're a blood relative that you're going to have anything in common. That's the definition of a family, actually. And some, you're committed to yourself, to each other, even though perhaps you don't. You know, I'm told that after World War II, there was, because it was the beginning of blood transfusions in a massive way, that there was a government project that tried to figure out the distribution of blood types in the population. So the newborns and their parents were kind of massively tested. And inadvertently, they figured out that 1 in 5 of the babies could not possibly have been the child of the father who thought he was the father, and probably 2 in 5 were not. Yeah. And you know that people were wandering around saying, oh, this, you know, just like Uncle Harry. And so I question our very narrow idea of inheritance, and I think it has to do suspiciously with possession. You know, with the owning of children as workers and passing on wealth, which I also question, from one generation to the next. We know that if you put a baby in a man's arms, his oxytocin level goes up. And we know that if you put a woman in combat, her testosterone level goes up. So, you know, it's so situational. And our bonding with each other is so much more broad than the narrow idea, you know, of a child who is biologically ours, that I would prefer to open up those doors.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the work, I mean, first of all, I definitely see in our society many people embracing transracial adoption and many other ways of creating a nuclear family that is not a biological family, strictly. But also, what you said about work is to me very profound, because I've been doing a lot of research on work for a book, and this idea of giving people a chance to have other pursuits, whether it's parenting, whether it's arts, church, mosque, whatever it is, that is a framework that we're grappling with in America, because the idea has been to, you know, just kind of put your nose to the grindstone and not particularly have a lot of time to nurture yourself or others. I'm wondering if our inability as a society to really give people a chance to nurture themselves and others while working hard is something that affects issues of equality broadly, gender and otherwise.
It does. And I think it's clear to all of us how it affects the poor. So I would like to address the rich and say they are bananas. You know, I mean, money is not interesting by itself. I met a woman who was a very successful investment banker, and we decided she was going to speak at Harvard, and she had no respect for Harvard either, so the business school. So we decided we should give a joint course called Money is Boring, with a little sub-seminar called How Much is Enough? Too many of the well-to-do, especially men, not only men, but especially men, have set a pattern of infinite collection of dollars for their own sake and objects for their own sake, which we know from every psychological study ever done does not create happiness. So we need them to set a better example. And of course, we are very economically divided, so we have to attend to that in very urgent terms. You talk about the financial crisis that we went through. The entire discussion was about banks and mortgages and so on. Nowhere did anyone say that I saw that equal pay would have been the best economic stimulus this economy could possibly have had. $200 billion more, that is, so that each woman gets paid as much as a white guy for doing the same work, which means that white women get more, African-American women get still more, Latinas get still more, you know, $200 billion. And those women are not going to put it in a Swiss bank account. They are going to spend it. And on top of that, stimulus, also it relieves the tax burden because of single-parent households, female-headed households, are the poorest. So why not talk about that?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. No, I mean, practical economics are a really critical part of, you know, every question of equality. I could go on forever, but we have to wrap up. And before I let you go, I would like to play a little game we call Exquisite. So we have a previous guest on One with Farai asking a question of the current guest. And of course, that's you. So let's take a listen.
If you look at the current advances in medicine and bioengineering, there's a fairly high likelihood that either we will have the ability to be immortal, or at least we will see how it might happen. First of all, is immortality a good thing or a bad thing? And how should we as human beings think about immortality?
That is Joy Ito of the MIT Media Lab. What do you think about the question of immortality?
I was all set to say, no, we don't want immortality. Everything is a cycle of life, you know, the plants, us, everything. And then I thought, well, I actually sort of think of myself as immortal. I'm 80 years old. I can't imagine leaving. I love it here. I love, you know, if not everything about it, most things about it. But there's just something wrong about it, about immortality, because think of nature. Think, you know, you would, what would that mean? You would miss the beauty of infancy, for instance. You wouldn't see people opening up in a natural way and growing in a natural way. No, I would be content just to have people able to use their unique individual talents and to understand in a deep way that we as human beings and nature too, that we are linked, not ranked.
Yeah.
And that would give us the best kind of immortality, which is empathy for others and for the future.
So it's your turn now. You get to ask a question of our next guest, and we're not going to tell you who that is. And you can ask anything you want.
What, when you do you forget what time it is when you're doing it because you love it so much? And are you able to do that?
I love that. That's a great question. And it's something that gets to this idea of passion that we really like to talk about here. So you are going to find out the answer to Gloria's question on the next episode of One with Farai. But for now, we're going to leave it here. Gloria, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Gloria Steinem is a writer and activist who's been involved in feminist and other social justice movements for decades. You've been listening to One with Farai, a part of Soundworks from PRI. I'm your host and executive producer, Farai Chidea. This program is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins. Our theme music is by the band Betty. Catch our next episode with playwright Scott Carter, who's also the executive producer of Real Time with Bill Maher on HBO. Visit soundworks.org to find other podcasts as well as past episodes of One with Farai.
One with Farai is supported in part by PRI's New Voices Fund, bringing new perspectives and personalities to public media. Donors to the fund include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation. Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.